Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh, it's Thursday, March 22nd, 2018. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. On this episode, a conversation about amateurism, firearms, and other various and sundry musings with a former justice on the state Supreme Court, Bob Orr. Your Honor, how are you?
I'm great. Delighted to be here, Jeff.
Serious question to start. Do you ever miss people rising when you enter a room?
No, I don't miss that, and you know, but people are still kind enough to refer to me as Judge, okay. So that makes me feel good. Although we have a new golden retriever puppy, and we named him the Little Judge.
I like that. Just before we started, you and I were talking about the possibility of a blue wave, or the likelihood or unlikelihood of a blue wave here in North Carolina in 2018. You write a weekly column for the Charlotte Observer, and just to pull the curtain back a little bit and talk about. Just to extend the conversation we were just having, a blue wave in North Carolina. You're not too warm on that theory as of this point. Why not?
Well, I think it's problematical. It's when you look at the districts, whether they're legislative or congressional districts, even with all the litigation and the losses sustained by the Republicans who drew those districts, they're still predominantly leaning towards Republican victories in those. The money will be following the power, and so the Republican Legislative Leadership Committees, the more powerful incumbents who are Republicans, will be substantially better funded than the Democrats. And candidly, I think the Republican focus on social issues has been put a little bit on the back shelf in favor of more traditional issues like teacher salaries, pre-K funding, tax relief, HB2. Nobody's talking about HB2.
I did also want to ask you about one of the stories of this week was a firearms proposal from the Democrats. I'll give a little context, then I'm going to throw you on the spot with something here. But I thought of you this week when this happened, because I knew we were going to be doing this interview. And there were five Democrats at the legislature who rolled out these gun proposals on Tuesday. I don't know if they were necessarily mirroring, but they were very similar to what Governor Cooper had rolled out last week or called for last week. We're talking about raising the age on assault rifles, expanded background checks on assault rifles, banning bump stocks, this possible restraining order to people that might be a threat, implementing a call center, more money for school resource officers and psychologists, all of those things.
Right.
And one of the things that did strike me candidly, as well as several other reporters and other people I heard from, was that these Democrats got up, talked about the proposal, and they said, this is not a partisan issue. But of course, there were only five Democrats at the podium. There wasn't a Republican there. And, you know, one of our jobs is just to question and poke holes in some of what we're seeing. And it just seemed like, all right, you know, is this about scoring political points, or is this really about an effort to make a policy difference? And it just struck us that there was no Republican up there. So here's my I would love for you to react to that to any extent that you want to. But my curveball to you is, had you been approached, and I'm assuming you weren't approached, had you been approached to stand up with a group of Democrats and call for a policy proposal like that, is that something that you would be behind?
Personally, I would at a minimum say these are extraordinarily important issues that should be considered in a nonpartisan light. And so therefore, I'm willing to say, let's get those kind of bills introduced, let's send them to committee, let's have hearings on these issues, and let's see if we can reach a reasonable compromise or proposals that would improve the safety, not just of the public schools, and that's obviously important, on everybody's mind, but as they say in the jargon, there are all sorts of soft targets out there that the public, including our children and grandchildren, are at risk. And so I wrote a op-ed piece for the Charlotte Observer a short time back, in which I said one of my real concerns is that the Republican Party is almost a wholly owned subsidiary of the NRA. And I think that's unfortunate in so many different ways. Not that protection of Second Amendment rights isn't a valid issue or concern, but it seems like we have this unwillingness politically to sit down and say, you know, we have a real problem in the country with the kinds of weapons that are out there, the inability of law enforcement, ATF agents, to adequately track and keep a record of who has them, who's buying them. I mean, there are all sorts of issues that we need to discuss in a nonpartisan way. But my answer, or my swing at your curveball, and I never was very good at hitting curveballs, that there needs to be a bipartisan discussion of these kinds of proposals. And you know, we've seen some, but they've mainly been focused at the school issue.
Have you always been a registered Republican? Were you ever an unaffiliated, or were you a Democrat way back in the day?
You know, I cannot lie on public radio.
You can't.
Okay. You know, and I'll tell you a little side story.
Please.
In doing so. My great-grandfather, who was a farmer in the western part of the state in Henderson County, refused to fight for the Confederacy, went over the mountains to East Tennessee with some other men, and joined the Union Army, and came back in after the Civil War as a Lincoln Republican. And so my family, on my father's side, have always been Republicans. And when I turned 21, back in the day when you had to be 21 to register, I asked one of my very good friends from Hendersonville and at UNC, Jim Fain, who was later Mike Easley's Commerce Secretary. I said, Jim, what should I do? Man, you know, I tend to be a Republican. And he said, Republicans have no voice in government. You know, just as a practical matter, you need to register as a Democrat. So I actually registered as a Democrat at age 21. But by the time I got out of the Army, went through law school, and moved to Asheville to practice law, it was clear to me that there wasn't a place for me in the Democrat Party and that I should be registered as a Republican. And so when I moved to Asheville in 75, I registered as a Republican.
Now, four decades later, does it feel like there's a small place for you within the Republican Party? I mean, has that coin kind of flipped for you personally?
Incredibly so, and in a very troubling way, because I actually worked as an intern for WSOC-TV in Charlotte's news department at the 65 and 67 legislative sessions, and Republicans were non-entities. I mean, and really treated unfairly in so many different ways. And so the early part of my political involvement was trying to build a Republican Party that was committed to good government and a responsible two-party system for the state. Mm-hmm. And when I was first elected to the Court of Appeals in 1988, I was the first Republican elected to a statewide judicial office since 1896. And so I have felt like in a lot of ways I've contributed in a small way to the growth of the Republican Party, but it's a very different party than during the years that I served as precinct and county chairman and worked in a lot of different capacities for the party. I wonder, is there a place for me in the party where people with my sort of old mountain Republican values?
Bob Orr is the guest here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. As you mentioned, you did win a statewide judicial race. You then won four more of them.
Four of them total. Yeah,
okay.
Right.
You were a candidate. You sought the nomination, the Republican nomination for governor in 2008. You did not win that race. Pat McCrory did. Then he went on to defeat In 2008, he went on to lose to Bev Perdue, and then he won the governorship 4 years later.
Right.
And the other order of business quickly is I'll apologize, as I did last week on the podcast, for my persistent cough, which I probably will not be able to edit out of the entire 20-minute stretch of the conversation here. So let's transition. March Madness continues tonight. There are four Sweet 16 games. And I want to chat about college basketball with you because college athletics and amateurism, and I'm using air quotes and student athletes, more air quotes, is something that you follow closely and are particularly passionate about. And just to get us started, I'm wondering why, of all the issues, is this one that you are so involved with or so interested
it's
in?
It's very ironic because I have been a college sports fan and particularly a UNC fan literally my entire life. I mean, I've been to Final Fours, bowl games. Between undergrad, working, and law school, I never missed a basketball game. I've loved college athletics. And in 2010, when the great scandal first broke at UNC,
Well,
at that point, it was, you know, Marvin Alston getting some money from an agent. But all of a sudden, all these players were suspended for the first game and subsequent games. And at one point, and I was running the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law at that time, I read an article about one of the players who had been suspended, Devin Ramsey. And he had been charged with academic fraud and was having to sit out. His career was over, according to the NCAA. And his mother had come down to talk with a reporter, and the story said she was in tears. This couldn't be happening. You know, her son had done nothing wrong. And frankly, I was just interested. And so through a press intermediary, I ended up meeting with Devin and his mother, and candidly, I was horrified with what had transpired in depriving this young man of an opportunity to play. And as his mother said, when you see your son's name scrolled across the ticker tape on ESPN's Thursday night football game that he's suspended for academic fraud, there is a huge personal impact. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I asked, would you like for me to see if I can try and, you know, get this reversed? And ultimately we did, but not without depriving Devin of most of that season and, you know, lots of bad publicity. And the more I learned about the way the NCAA operated, you know, what was happening at UNC to the players, It really turned me into an advocate for reform and candidly has greatly dampened my enthusiasm for college sports. It's a broken system in which billions of dollars are in play and the relatively small number of young men who are the football and basketball talents that produce the money are treated for the most part in a lot of ways, poorly.
Among the teams playing tonight are Kentucky and Michigan. I would just note that the head coach of the Wolverines, John Beilein, makes $3.3 million. Head coach of the Wildcats, John Calipari, makes just about $8 million a year. That's according to an annual database that USA Today produces. From a financial standpoint, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I think I've seen you use the word exploitation before on Twitter.
Right.
Do you have a proposal if you could wave your magic wand and play amateurism god for a day or strike it however you wanted to handle it? Financially speaking, what is your proposal? What is your idea to perhaps diminish or remove that exploitation that you and others have talked about?
Well, there are a range of issues. You know, one of the big questions is, do you compensate only the teams that are producing revenue, so that you know, men's golf, women's volleyball don't get revenue? But I think those, they're broader reform issues there. But from a compensation standpoint, I'm sort of a free market guy. Hey, mm-hmm. I'm a registered Republican, you know? And so the only individual on a college campus that can't generate money from his or her talents are college athletes. Everybody from the chancellor to the athletic director to professors writing books to talented musicians and actors who are students have the ability to earn money, to have agents represent them. But if you're an athlete, you lose all your college eligibility.
The NCAA prohibits.
Yeah, it's prohibited by the rules. And so, you know, one of the things I would do is simply open up. If a car dealership in Raleigh wants to pay an NC State basketball player, you know, $5,000 to do an ad, hey, that, it's a free market. You know, they ought to be able to do that. And so I think it gets a little tougher when you get down into the non-revenue sports. But the so-called cost of attendance, which the NCAA is, I think they now have a $5,000 cap, mm-hmm. Is pretty unrealistic for a lot of kids coming out of really low-income families. And let's face it, a lot of the talented kids are minority kids. They come out of backgrounds that don't have a lot of resources. And I hear stories from former players, from coaches about how these kids take their Pell Grant money or they take mm-hmm. their cost of living and they send it home so that their mother can literally feed other members of the family. And so I think we just have to be fair, right? And, you know, what that means and how that's determined would have to be determined, have to be evaluated in a lot of different ways. But Mark Emmert, who makes, what, $2 million, is running the NCAA, mm-hmm. he says, oh, we are categorically against paying players. Now, see, I think the NCAA wants us talking about paying players because the average fan of college sports finds that offensive. You know, what I'm talking about is how do we share the wealth mm-hmm. in some fair way with all of these young men and women who are promoting the universities, feeding the soon-to-be online ACC sports network, you know, that everybody's making money off of.
And with the exception of?
With the exception of the students. And, you know, then you get to the education. And so, yeah, some kids get a good education. But if you're coming into Chapel Hill or NC State or a private institution like Duke and you have fairly mediocre grades and scores coming out of a rural North Carolina school, you're going to struggle competing in college generally. But if you now work that individual 40, 50 hours right. a week, they miss, you know, 3 or 4 days of class to travel to these games, you know, you're putting them in an untenable academic position, which is why you have the kind of scandal that erupted at UNC. But all schools have some way of dealing with the academic difficulties of their athletes because they're of no value if they're not eligible.
One more quick follow-up on sure. this, and I don't admittedly know a ton about it. I heard him mention it in an interview this week. John Calipari, the coach of Kentucky, mentioned that he offers his players lifetime scholarships. Now, I don't know the feasibility of that and how many players, because, of course, Calipari has a lot of one-and-done guys,
right.
actually come back and utilize that. Is that something you would be in favor of, Carolina, Duke State? If all Division I schools said, hey, we're going to give you a lifetime scholarship, meaning you come for 2 years, you go to the NFL, the NBA, right. MLB, whatever, and you want to come back when you're 28, 42, 60, and get a degree? Is that feasible?
I think it is, and I think it's fair. I mean, what UNC's attempting to raise $2 billion, you know, some of which is going to athletic construction. They're building a $45 million indoor practice facility. I mean, surely we can afford to give these kids that help us win a national championship. Tony Bradley, mm-hmm. you know, left UNC after 1 year after winning the national championship a year ago. Why shouldn't he be able to come back if he chooses to do that? But one of my real concerns is, you know, a lot of these young men, and particularly in the women's sports, won't have professional opportunities. And so if we're dumbing down their education, if we're watering it down, if we're putting them in majors that are really not going to provide them with good opportunities, and we're putting all this academic pressure because they have to take at least 12 semester hours, and it's tough for them to do any kind of internships, to do all the sort of normal things that college kids do. I mean, that's one of the key areas. I would say if a young man can only handle 6 semester hours during the season, mm-hmm. let them take just 6 semester hours. If they need to take remedial math at a community college, let them take remedial math at a community college. You know, now I understand that that goes against the grain of the purity of college amateurism and the so-called student athlete, but let's do what's right for these kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that hard, but everybody making money doesn't want to, sort of mess with the system.
Right.
And the people who are on the short end of it are the kids. And this is how we, you know, you end up with these, you know, this under the table money. Is by putting all of these unrealistic restrictions on the students, the athletes. There is this incentive for people to slip them money in order to, get them to sign with them after they leave the school.
Right.
So with a more open, honest system, a fair system, I think you'd do away with a lot of those problems.
Bob Orr earned an undergraduate degree at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, also a law degree from there. He will be rooting for the Fine Institute of Syracuse University tomorrow night as they take on Duke. It's anybody but Duke, right? ABD, some Carolina.
That's correct. We do not pull for Duke. But I have a daughter in graduate school at Clemson, so, and they're still in the Sweet 16, so that's one shade of orange I'm willing to enthusiastically embrace.
As your tie demonstrates this morning, this morning.
Yeah.
Transitioning, you are reading a book, and I wanted to let you loose for a moment and tell us a little bit about this book you're reading. It's called Grant. It's a biography about Ulysses S. Grant, of course, the general.
Right.
It's written by Ron Chernoff.
We think that's correct.
We think that's a Ukrainian pronunciation of his name.
Yeah.
And there may or may not be some modern-day lessons in this book from this Reconstruction period.
It's a remarkable biography about an individual, Ulysses S. Grant, that at least in the book, they quote several contemporary historians to say he is the most underappreciated president in the history of the United States. And the part, obviously, about his rise from sort of a checkered early military career, getting booted out, problems with alcohol, unable to successfully operate a business, and then the Civil War breaks out, and next thing you know, he ends up commander in chief of the Union forces and wins the Civil War. That's all interesting. I love history, love Civil War history. What I have found remarkable, though, is the portion on Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so relevant and so useful in the context of race relations in this country today, with the ongoing Confederate monument debate, not just in North Carolina, but around the country. And what I find stunning, thinking of myself as a student of history, of North Carolina history and the like, how little I knew and understood about Reconstruction, mm-hmm. and sort of the subsequent suppression of the recently freed slaves post-Reconstruction. And Grant, interestingly enough, was a great champion of civil rights. I mean, I think that's one of the unique things that I discovered in this book, that in a lot of ways, he more than any single person attempted to help the newly freed slaves in their transition to freedom and citizenship. But the violence and hatred and intimidation, particularly in the South, of the newly freed black citizens was extraordinary, and something that in the history books I read growing up, in the history books I read at UNC, was glossed over, ignored. It was stunning. And I think in reading what happened in Reconstruction and, mm-hmm. and post-Reconstruction, as a Southerner, I came away with a far better appreciation for the mindset of African Americans even today,
mm-hmm.
Because truly it wasn't until the 1960s and 70s that we really started seeing significant civil rights. And there was a quote, I pulled it out so I could read it, because okay. I knew we were going to talk about this. But Frederick Douglass is quoted in the book about wondering whether abolitions for the black man had actually turned out good. And his quote was, having been freed from the slaveholder's lash, is he to be subject to the slaveholder's shotgun? Hmm. And the history of Reconstruction, which has not been, to my mind, accurately and broadly enough described and talked about, was the story of voter intimidation. And one of the most interesting things was that the backlash was not so much that the black citizens were now free, they weren't slaves, but they had the right to vote. I mean, and I found that stunning, that the vicious backlash was really against the prospects of black people having the voting franchise. It's a stunning book.
Ron Chernoff wrote the book. It is called Grant. If you're looking for some spring reading, Judge Bob Orr likes it a lot.
It's not short, 950 pages.
You historians in your yeah. long books.
Yeah.
A few rapid-fire questions to get you out of here on. One significant mistake you made as a gubernatorial candidate in 2008?
Well, thinking that really good ideas could overcome a lack of money to start with. I had the advice of a consultant, find 1,000 friends who will say they'll give you $1,000 each. You don't have to have them give it to you. And I thought, nah, we'll raise. You got to have the money. I didn't have it.
Best job you had as a teenager?
As a teenager, candidly, my freshman year at UNC, and I was a radio, TV, motion picture major.
Nice.
I was going to be a sports announcer, not a lawyer and judge. But WSOC TV News in Charlotte, who used to send 2 full-time reporters to cover the legislature,
wow.
needed an intern. And so I would come over 3 or 4 days a week after classes and work the legislature, which is how I got interested in law and politics. But it was fascinating. I literally, as a teenager, covered Richard Nixon, Martin Luther King, Klan rallies, the speaker ban. I mean, it was a remarkable education,
mm-hmm.
For a young kid from Western North Carolina.
Which elected official in North Carolina gives you the most reason for hope or optimism?
The current elected officials?
A current elected official, oh, local, state, or federal. And you can say none.
From a Republican perspective, Chuck McGrady. You know, Chuck obviously is a great conservationist, supporter of the environment. I think he's a well-reasoned individual, and I don't always agree with him, but he's open to discussion, and I have a lot of respect for Chuck.
after the next 4 days of basketball, which four teams will still be playing?
You know, once, and despite my lack of
you don't have a bracket in front of
well,
you.
Well, I'm going to say, all right, let's say Syracuse. That'll make you happy.
Hey,
all
I
right,
like it.
Let's say Clemson, because that'll make me. I don't even know whether I don't even know
bracket.
How the brackets.
They would have run. To play each other in the Elite Eight.
Would they? All right.
So you're
going to
pick Clemson. Then.
Yeah, I have to pick Clemson. Florida State's in there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why not pick Florida State? Go with the ACC. But beyond that, Gonzaga. Where do they? They
I believe
fall?
They yeah. play Florida State tonight.
Yeah.
We can check on that. I mean, again, this is what happens when you throw these curveball questions at people.
Yeah, I know.
Florida State and Gonzaga tip at 10:07 tonight.
Okay, so realistically, probably Gonzaga. Let's say Gonzaga, Clemson, Villanova and
I'll give you the rundown in the
Who's the school
the
out
South.
Of Chicago?
Loyola.
Loyola. Why not? What's the sister, you know, that's
98-year-old sister. Yeah. I'm going to call her Sister Mary Catherine, but it's not Mary Catherine.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting her name. But yes.
How can you pull against a 98-year-old nun?
You can't. All right. Loyola, Gonzaga, Clemson, and Villanova.
A lot of Catholics in there.
Tipping your hand here.
Yeah.
Bob Orr, a former member of the North Carolina Supreme Court. Thanks for the conversation. This was fun.
Oh, great. Look forward to doing it again sometime.
And thank you, as always, for listening to the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can subscribe to the program on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. Stay up to date on North Carolina political news throughout the week at our website, wunc.org. And we'll do this again next week. For Judge Bob Orr, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Talk to you soon.